Good morning. Happy Tuesday. Everybody's favorite committee is about to begin. So I call the meeting of the Capital Investment Committee today, Tuesday, February 25th, to order. And Representative Carroll, you've been studying those minutes. I am wondering if you might have a motion to approve those minutes from Thursday, February 20th.
Madam Chair, you know, I'm dismayed. So I'm so moved.
Perfect. Thank you, Representative Carroll. Do we have any discussion? Okay. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Fantastic. And there is a quorum present, everybody's favorite thing to hear. And we are going to hear some more governor bonding requests from state agencies. But, you guys, we have a fun day on the deck for us. Look at those cute little animals. We're going to hear from the Minnesota Zoo and a visit from the zoo animals, as well as we're going to also do the Met Council and the Minnesota Historical Society. So we're going to start with the zoo. And if you want to state your name for the record, and go ahead and start your presentation.
I'm Alexandria Tassa, Judy Armstrong, and here we have some of our ambassador animals at the zoo. So I hope you're all right. We're going to walk around because that's what these animals do. Their job is to meet visitors and staff at the zoo and also throughout the state up close like this. So no worries, nobody's going to jump. But this is quite a treat. One of our ambassador animals, it's actually a really popular one. It is a Solomon Island skink, S-K-I-N-K, skink, not skink. and they're called the rainforest lizard. And this is a really fun animal for us that we get to bring out. We also have it in our shows at the zoo too, so that our guests can see animals that you might not necessarily see right here in our own backyard, but still have a great impact in nature. And so one of the jobs for this animal is agreeing to the nature's recycler. And so your mission, connecting people, animals, and the natural world to save wildlife. Well, here you go. Here is an important one, even all the way in the Solomon Islands. Yeah, we can tie it right back home here to Minnesota because we have nature recycling as well. It might not be a skink like this, but it could be any of like our kind of creepy crawlies that we have here, as well as our decomposers. Now, this cool lizard is considered a large skink. We have skinks in Minnesota, and our skinks are probably about this long. So this is considered a giant skink for its size. And the cool thing about this one is it's made for living in the tree. So check out that really cool tail that you notice. It is a graspy, prehensile tail. So it's like a seatbelt for climbing in trees. And then this little fella has a lot of long toes and some really sharp claws. They're made for living in the trees. And if he's sticking out his tongue at you, he's saying, good morning. Hello. How are you doing today?
Remember when I stick my tongue out at you guys. It's good morning.
Yeah, just say hello. Some of our collection that we have, that we take care of, have been really dark green, like our shirts that you see here. Some have been like a gray green. This one's a fun kind of yellowish green, but it helps them to camouflage with where they live. So a really fun ambassador animal. This is just one of the types of lizards that we bring out, whether it's at a school or a hospital, assisted living, or right here at the zoo when people are coming to visit us as our guests. You can see that shows for them what we do. We have lots of mammals, reptiles, birds, and all those little creepy crawlies and vertebrates too. But you know what? I'll have a place at the zoo for us. I know he's getting that really well today. So Judy has another guest to share with you. Maybe some of you don't like the cool critters. So she'll warm it up for you.
Yeah, warm and fuzzy. Thanks, Alex. So here we have our South American chinchilla. And I just have to stand here so you can take a picture of it. You were noticing those little whiskers moving around quite a bit, so smelling and sensing, big giant ears to help them hear, and then, of course, these two animals are some of our animal ambassadors, so animals that come out and visit the public, and school kids, visitors to the zoo, or we travel with our outreach program. There's some of the animals that go so that we can tell our story, and then all those learners are experiencing something a little bit different. They might be someone that hears things, they might be someone that sees something. occasionally we do get a little bit closer, and they get up the close up so you can get a little more experience. And a chinchilla doesn't ever take a bath. So they only take a bath in sand. They have such resistance for that they can get wet because they would be able to fluff and dry up.
So. Do they live in the wild?
They live in the Andes Mountains in Peru. And they aren't a species that would bought up. They're protected and they're not very sorry. There's a lot of conservation programs going on.
No, maybe questions?
Yeah, sure. Any questions? I know there's got to be a couple because they're pretty cool.
What are their names?
They do. That's a great question. So the zoo has a number for everybody, just like we have a social security number, right? But we do give them names. This is Pepper because Pepper has speckles, like pepper flakes on there. And then Judy has Nimbus. After a cloud, because they're so fluffy, they have such light fur, folks, that when their hair goes off, it doesn't straight fall to the ground. It actually goes airborne first, because it is such fine hair. We have one hair per follicle that's coming out. They have 60, because where they live is quite different from our tropical lizard. They live in the Andes Mountains, like Judy said, so they need to have that built-in fur to keep them warm. It's winter every day where they live, so Minnesota in the wintertime is fantastic for them. But that's also why they don't take that bath that you mentioned, because they get wet. It's like you wearing a wet winter coat outside, not your ears. So, yeah, really cool fur for them. Yeah. Great question. Any other questions about them? Favorite colors?
So, thank you, guys. Madam Chair, committee members, I personally want to thank Judy and Alex. As the director of the zoo, we're very proud. They've been traveling, I don't know their tenure, but how many years have you guys? 20 and 30 years. They've been bringing animals to people that cannot get to the zoo all over Minnesota, a lot of hospitals, a lot of nursing homes, a lot of special care facilities. So I just personally want to thank them so much because I've seen them in action a lot, and they're really great. So thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Well, that was fun, members. I could almost take that chinchilla home. And I'm not really one for reptiles, but he is a little cutie, isn't he? Let's see here. We're going to start with Director Frawley and Dr. Is it Rivas?
Dr. Rivas, yes.
Fantastic. And we're going to hear about the need for the hospital at the Minnesota Zoo.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and community members. John Frawley, Director of the Minnesota Zoo. With me today, Dr. Rivas, head of our vet programs. We're going to tag team on this presentation a little bit back and forth. I'll start the presentation with a little bit of, first we'll cover a little Zoo 101. We are going to cover our bonding request, the challenges of our current hospital that we have at the zoo. We do have a little bit of a glimpse at the new hospital center that we're hoping to build. And then obviously we want to talk a little bit about asset preservation needs around the zoo, which are great. So a little bit to remind you of the zoo, we are a state agency, public-private partnership. We are a very unique state agency in the fact that we only get 37%, this last funding, we've got 37% of our general funds from the state, 63% we need to raise ourselves like any Main Street business. So we have to roll up our sleeves and have a good business plan as well as receiving some state funds. We're the fifth largest zoo in the country. Most zoos are less than 30 acres. We are a huge zoo. We have a 24/7 campus, 365 days a year. So we are like operating a hospital itself or a small city. We are Minnesota's top gated attraction. Last year we hit 1.5 million visitors. So we are a major destination as a state agency. We're very proud that we reached those types of numbers. It's the highest attendance in the history of the zoo. So we're very proud of that. We also serve over 120,000 people free. A lot of people don't know that we are a free zoo to those who need us to be free. If somebody qualifies for general assistance, you come to the zoo for free any day you want. We are large, biggest environmental educator in the state, reaching over 83,000 students, over 1,000 schools. We are the largest, we host the largest zoo camp in the nation. So we are really strong on education. And all that said, people still call us a new zoo, but the campus itself is 50 years old. and as you know, is aging all at the same time. So our request is for a new animal hospital building. $17,675,000 is the request. Our asset preservation request is $3,810,000 with our total there in front of you. So I'm going to pass it on to Dr. Rivas to tell you a little bit about the hospital, and then I'll come back in.
Thank you, Director Frawley. So as he said, our campus is approximately 50 years old, and the current hospital was the very first building built at the Minnesota Zoo before anything else opened up, which is why we are now having this mission-critical project to replace the outdated facility. It was first built in 1975, and it lacks the essential infrastructure to meet USDA and other regulatory standards in the veterinary industry, which poses significant risk to both animals and humans. As you can see here, the facility is not equipped to handle the approximately 5,000 animals at the zoo of great diversity of species, putting humans and animals in difficult working environments that are not ergonomic or safe. Our current hospital is deteriorating, particularly the animal holding spaces, which makes it impossible to properly house the diverse array of animals that call the Minnesota Zoo home. You can see on the left here some of our external holding areas that are no longer safe to hold animals and are in a condition that does not make sense to repair, would have to be replaced entirely to make them suitable for housing animals going forward. Additionally, our outdated surgical and treatment spaces for animals to perform procedures in are too small and also lack proper ventilation, posing risk to both humans and animals. You can see these surgical and treatment spaces here on this slide. We have struggled with a high rate of surgical infections due to the improper ventilation and just general challenges with working with animals in the space. That's a mountain lion on a folding table because we don't have room for a proper large animal surgical table in this area. One of the biggest challenges that inspired this project is the lack of outdoor garage or lack of indoor loading dock. The veterinary team is unable to keep our hospital vans ambulance ready with the necessary equipment and medications for rapid animal care because the vehicles are stored outside, so our medical supplies will be exposed to the extremes of the Minnesota climate, and that is not sustainable for their longevity. This is also a very difficult workspace for our staff. If you can imagine, every animal that comes to the hospital has to come in through this space up and over this loading dock, regardless of the weather, regardless of the time of day. So think about loading tigers, brown bears in and out over this dock. It's not a great work environment. And then you're also working out there in the weather conditions. We've actually had a staff veterinarian sustain a concussion out here when she went to grab an oxygen tank out of a van and slipped on the ice and hit her head on the concrete.
Okay, so we have obviously proposing a new hospital and wellness center for the Minnesota Zoo. The new facility has four main components to it. One is we want a world-class facility here in Minnesota, and so that's our primary, is that we can service those 5,000 animals Dr. Rivas talked about in a modern way. We also want this facility to be a teaching hospital. It serves the entire state, and actually it serves the country, which she'll talk about a little bit about. We want this to also address human health as well as animal health. And this new facility is designed to have partnerships and serve all of Minnesota. So the hospital itself is a $30 million project. We have received, and thank you, we've received previous state funding for the design, and we are in the middle of the design stages. We have our state request, but what I'm really excited about for the committee to know that we've been working on this project for almost 5 years, and thank you for all the tours that everybody's taken. During this time, we have been raising money privately, and we've continued to work on raising money privately, and right now, we've just passed the $9 million mark of raising $9 million privately for this project. We always try to do that as much as we can. Our donors are a little bit fatigued, but they've really stepped up to make this hospital come to fruition, so we're glad to report that. Any other funds remaining, the foundation hopefully can cover those as well, as in with the request itself. I'm going to pass it back to Dr. Rivas.
So we want to share a little bit about what we're hoping to achieve with this new facility, both for the Minnesota Zoo as well as for our statewide partnerships with other animal and wildlife agencies. So the key thing is to create a safer, more ergonomic workspace to work with wildlife and zoo animal species and provide them the proper medical care that they need at current industry standards. This also provides additional diagnostic options like a new CT scanner equipped to handle the wide variety of patients from corals to dairy cattle that we care for at the Minnesota Zoo. It provides a new larger surgical suite as well as that proper large animal operating table, so we're no longer having dangerous carnivores on a folding table when we're caring for them at the zoo. Of course, we are also looking forward to providing a new indoor ambulance bay that helps keep our vehicles at a more consistent temperature so we can store our medical supplies that we need at a moment's notice in them. It also allows features for safely transporting animals in and out of the hospital. And again, this is not just for our Minnesota Zoo animals, but also our partner agencies that may be bringing their animals to this facility for that higher level of specialist care. And it will be centrally located on the zoo grounds. The current hospital is over a mile away from the main zoo. It was built as a quarantine facility, and it makes it hard to provide urgent and emergent care for animals at the zoo. We are also looking to provide updated animal holding spaces that are safer for the animals as well as the people taking care of them. These are to serve as recovery spaces for animals that are convalescing, coming back from illnesses or injuries, rescue animals that the zoo takes in to help our other state partners, as well as quarantine spaces for new animals to make sure they don't bring diseases with them to the zoo, and treatment spaces for those animals while they're in hospital, along with updated monitoring equipment like cameras that allow us to watch these shy animals remotely to better understand how they are coping while they're in our care. One of the key features is to make this into a teaching hospital for our zoo guests and Minnesota residents, as well as people throughout the country. This provides viewing areas for the public so they can observe procedures as they are happening. And this includes routine zoo guests as well as school field trips. We're also looking to create more conference spaces for teaching and learning opportunities for veterinarian conferences and workshops, as well as veterinary student internships and externships, and opportunities to collaborate better for research and preventative health work on these species and advancing treatment of zoological and wildlife species.
One really unique part of this hospital, something I learned, is that we need to build vet hospitals with human health. A few years ago, researching this project, I learned that the career of being a veterinarian or a vet tech is one of the highest mental illness levels of any career. In fact, the suicide rate in veterinarians is 4 or 5% higher than most occupations. And a lot of it comes back into the workspace and the work facilities. So we are designing this building with WELL building standards. We want to set a, kind of a tone for the country of how to do these types of buildings the right way for not just the animals, but for the people. The other unique design feature that we have is we don't need a lot of exotic hospitals like this in Minnesota. We need one good one. But the fact is we need this one to help everybody in the state of Minnesota. So we are working around the state, and we have a lot of partnerships already. I have two or three more coming online right now, working with the Minnesota Vet Association to really make sure that this hospital can serve all of Minnesota. So yes, it's at the Minnesota Zoo and serving the zoo, but we are going to have multiple partnerships and access for everybody around the state and the expertise that we have. We're seeing a lot of exotics around Minnesota, and we get phone calls every day from vets all over the state for help. So this will help every vet in your hometown will be able to come here for workshops, help with their animals that they're seeing in their counties.
The other part we would like to touch on is the general veterinary crisis in Minnesota, as well as the country as a whole. Livestock producers in general, but as well as small and equine veterinarians, are facing a shortage of qualified veterinarians to fulfill the needs as they continue to expand. According to the USDA, the shortage of rural veterinarians reached an all-time high in 2023, with 500 counties across 46 states classified as having a critical need for large animal vets, seven of which were located here in Minnesota. And although the rural veterinary field is perhaps greatest pressed by this, it's felt throughout the veterinary profession, particularly in our post-pandemic age. Our goal with having this as a teaching hospital is to continue to inspire and help recruit the next generation of veterinarians, veterinary technicians, animal care professionals. A lot of folks come to the industry thinking they want to work with these exotic, really different species, and it's not necessarily the career path everyone is going to take, but it is a gateway to bring them in, help them learn about the opportunities, develop their passions, and then find their niche in the field.
Madam Chair, committee members, we also would like to just bring up that the Minnesota Zoo, like we said, is a 50-year-old zoo, 50-year-old campus, and we do have 3.8 million requests for a lot of the deferred maintenance throughout the zoo. This obviously, you know, heat plants, boilers, bridges, decking, a lot of things you're seeing throughout Minnesota. The zoo has some of those same challenges. With that, Madam Chair, committee members, I would stand for questions.
Thank you. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for presenting today and for bringing the friends to see us. I've toured the veterinary hospital twice now on bonding tours and have been watching it become more and more in need. I've also been impressed by watching the people who are there training and working and the quality of people and the dedication. I do have a couple of questions about the funding. I know that last year or last cycle, it was the governor's top priority, and I see that you differ now from the governor's recommendation. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. Madam Chair,
Mr. Crowley,
committee members, as my understanding, the governor's rec really focused on asset preservation instead of a capital project such as this one. I think it was the same situation last year, but we were able to work and get this in front of both committees and move forward with the same situation as it was last year. But I think that's, you know, the way the governor approached it with his request, right?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. About the asset preservation, the handout says that lists the priority needs, and it's a $3.81 million ask. How much of these needs, how far does that go, and do you have specific priorities within that? What would you want to do with those funds specifically? Thank you.
Mr. Frawley.
Madam Chair, committee members, you know, our list of asset preservation is a long list. I think that's probably true with pretty much all state facilities. We do have a prioritization list and a sequencing list, and that has to do with safety for humans and animals and priorities. Some of the top needs of that $3.8 million right now is our boiler system at the Minnesota Zoo. I've just found out it failed this last year. And I found out that it was bought used 42 years ago at the zoo. So there was an $850,000 emergency fix, but that was just a temporary fix. So things like heating, which is a life support system, heat is a life support system for people and for animals when we have the species that we have. Those types of pump stations, heat stations, the boiler systems would be some of the priorities for this year.
All right. Next up, let's see Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question for either one of the individuals on the panel, I was just kind of wondering, is there any money currently being supplied by any of your partner groups like the Lake Superior Zoo or North American Bear Center, Great Lakes, University of Minnesota, anything like that?
Mr. Frawley?
Yep, Madam Chair, committee members, not at this time, no.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other question I had is, can you help me understand a little bit more about the relationship you have with the University of Minnesota Vet School and some of the teaching components that they're working on, along with what you guys are proposing for your teaching components?
Who would like to take that? Dr. Rivas?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I can take that. So we've worked with the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine in several capacities. I think some of the biggest places we've overlapped have been their anesthesia department. Obviously, to work with our animals, most of them are not going to let us come up and put a stethoscope on them, so anesthesia is a big part of their job. So we take on their anesthesia residents to help them get the required caseload and non-traditional species they need to credential as part of their residency. We also take on University of Minnesota veterinary students as part of their fourth year clinical rotations to gain additional animal experience outside the traditional dog, cat, horse, cow, pig that you get in veterinary school. And we collaborate with them in a variety of research capacities. Last year, we received Merck Animal Foundation funding for a veterinary summer scholars project with, in collaboration with the University of Minnesota. We have a very close working relationship with the Minnesota Raptor Center, and we send our staff back and forth between the two facilities to collaborate on projects that cater to our own unique expertise. And have also worked with them and with their various specialists, dentists, et cetera, which provides opportunities, one, for us to get the highest level of care for our animals from specialists in the field, but it also improves career satisfaction for their staff, for staff retention, as well as additional training opportunities for their students, interns, and residents.
Representative Allen, you have a follow-up?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, for entertaining me on this. I was just kind of wondering, are you guys still currently working with the University of Minnesota as far as shipping animals over there to get work or anything like that done? And when I was in college at the U of M, I did do a stint at the vet school there, and it was always interesting when we had one of the guests coming over from the Minnesota Zoo. So I was just kind of wondering about that. Thank you.
Dr. Rivas?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we do work with them on that. We do it on a case-by-case basis. I think one of the things to note is historically, the Minnesota Zoo did not have veterinarians that had trained specifically in zoo medicine. They kind of went the experiential route into the career and relied more heavily on the University of Minnesota. My current staff have all done some form of residency training and are board certified in zoo medicine. So now the expertise for caring for those animals is housed at the zoo versus externally. So what we end up actually doing is helping the university more with their non-traditional species versus our animals used to go to them. We help them more. That doesn't mean we still don't work with them. We do have a number of domestic species through our Wells Fargo family farm. So my morning started today at 6:30 a.m. with one of our Clydesdale horses colicking, and the first stop for that, if we can't stabilize it, is the University of Minnesota. So it is the relationship is perhaps different than what it might have been 10 years ago, but it's still a strong partnership, and we regularly speak with the dean of the vet school on how to continue to evolve with our changing needs.
So good. All right. Thanks, Representative Allen. Representative Zhang, enlighten us. Oh, goodness gracious. I got excited because you don't speak up very much. Let's see. Oh, Representative Scraba, of course. You'll fill in the void.
That is my job. Nobody's figured that out on this committee. I have a purpose. First of all, I want to thank you for coming here and giving the tour. That was one of the most enlightening tours, seeing the hospital, imagining taking a wild or a tiger, an animal that's not humanized, to move it from its cage to surgery and not have it where it's caged the whole way. It's like you just bring it out in the open and que sera, sera. Something happens, it happens. If it wakes up, if the meds weren't right, whatever it is. And it's kind of like, this is safety, safety for the workers, safety for the public, safety for everyone. So very enlightening. And I appreciate you guys going around the state, looking at the different, we have two in Ely, the Bear Center and the Wolf Center, International Wolf Center. And to kind of ask your quick question, Representative Allen, a lot of these organizations aren't in a position to take donor money and give it to someone else. They expect it to stay with them, and it's kind of a dog-eat-dog world out there in this, and pun intended, by the way. So I appreciate you guys coming here, and I didn't have a question. I just fill in space. Thank you.
All right, Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's tough to follow up Representative Scraba, but...
Yeah, mine will be a little similar, I guess. So I've been on a bunch of tours to your place, and I guess generally mine are more comments. I think you've been really good stewards of the money that you receive through this committee and through Legacy, and kind of a testament. So I have no doubt that you'll spend the money well. had an interesting opportunity this summer, which I never had because I've always been on the daily side, but went there for one of your concert series this summer, and it was a totally different venue, and what a great place to be in at night. You know, there's different activity, and it was a little bit more adult, not that I don't like kids, and being there with my grandkids, but it was pretty fun to, for the concert, and walk on your skywalk, and just even got a camel ride, so that was kind of pretty neat. But anyways, thank you for being good stewards of the money.
Hey, does anybody else have any? Oh, Representative Fogelman.
Thanks for coming today. It's always fun to have the zoo here. You've asked for this money. I know the last biennium when I was here, you asked for that. And here we are again. If you don't get that money for this hospital again this time, what's that going to look like going to the future? I mean, how long can you keep going in the facility as it is right now?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Frawley.
Committee members, thank you for that question. That's a very hard question. Literally every single day I worry about this hospital. I think Dr. Rivas and I share that. We're doing procedures in the field. We're doing procedures where we shouldn't be doing procedures because it doesn't make sense to bring them to a hospital that doesn't work. So it is a continued stress. The staff have done an amazing job. We have increased our vet staff even to be able to counter some of the lack of facilities, but even that puts a lot of stress on us. We, like I said, when we, there was no bonding bill last year, we just continued to raise money privately, and we have, like I said, are really proud that we've raised over $9 million. Like I said, that's a hard raise right now with a lot of donor fatigue, so we don't have hopes that that could we can raise much more. So this is really priority emergency funding for the Minnesota Zoo. We have 5,000 animals entrusted in our care. We have the health of our staff. So I don't have a good answer other than every day is hard to wait. The other thing with this project is this is probably a year and a half construction project too. So there's a lot of timing that we're gonna have to cover until this facility is built. So timing is urgent, and we've been working on this project for 5 years. So that's, it's been really urgent. So.
Vice Chair Fogelman.
I see that you have the asset preservation list as 3.8 million is what was recommended, and you have 67 million in deferred maintenance. If that would get funded and the hospital didn't get funded, I mean, which one's the more of the necessity, I guess I would ask.
Mr. Frawley.
Committee members, our hospital is our most critical need right now. Obviously, asset preservation, we have some critical projects that we've outlined with other committee members, like our boiler is, you know, in need. So we have, they all come in the form of life support systems, I think. So these are, you know, what we're bringing to the committee is these top life support system needs, and so they're both, you know, parallel, and so that's, I think, you know, but if, you know, at this point in this committee meeting, I'd say both of those are critical at this point in the session.
Thank you, Representative Fogelman. I do have a question, Mr. Frawley. So the treetop trail, try saying that many times. I will not say it more than twice. was privately funded, correct? Just out of curiosity, why that project was put ahead of the hospital, if the hospital is in dire straits and needing assistance, and because we're getting asked that. So
that's fine. Yep.
Thank you.
Committee Chair, Madam Chair, committee members. The Street Top Trail was driven by a private donor initially with a $10 million gift. And so that's, I think, what got that project jump-started. That was a donor choice. And then the state did match that donor, those early funds with an $11 million of support. The Tree Top Trail, although obviously it seems like a public or a public-facing project and not like an emergency behind the scenes project, it is, it also raising, you know, two-thirds of our money is privately raised. So we have to have a zoo that people want to come to and continue to drive our gate, because we only get one-third of our funding from the state. So what we try to do is we try to balance, you know, driving tenants to the zoo and having reasons for people to come to the zoo with, you know, the deferred maintenance and the needs of the zoo as far as infrastructure needs. So it's a delicate balance because we have to keep, we're not fully funded from the state. We only get one-third. So I think we have to look at each project, and that project was donor-driven at that time. This goes back 9 years. We were also, when we first looked at the animal hospital, when that project was moving forward, the animal hospital, we were looking at a renovation possibly for the hospital, and that took a couple years of architectural investigation, and we found that the hospital was not able to be repaired. So it was a little bit of a timing. But those are the reasons, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Frawley, and that's why you're in the position that you're in and we are not there. So thank you for the work that you do. A lot of decisions to make, I assume, that are not very easy to. Representative Carroll, and then unless there's other member questions, Representative Carroll will have the last question.
Thank you. So thank you, right Chair. Ahead.
Yeah, we're saving the best for last.
Well, I don't know about that, but I appreciate it.
Until we have to.
So I see we have some FFA kids here. Mm-hmm. And thanks for coming. I grew up with FFA in my community. I grew up in a small farming community. I was a town kid, though. I wasn't a farm kid. And so there was there wasn't a rivalry between them, but there was a difference. And so I appreciate the FFA, and because of that, you know, we had a vet in town, and he did both large animal and small animal. And as I recall back then, there was a shortage of veterinarians. And this is kind of a convoluted question, but it made me think about what you guys had said in terms of the need for vets. And are you doing anything in your capacity to help increase veterinary student capacity? It's a very limited enrollment. There seems to be a growing demand, and what, if anything, is being done? This may be out of your realm, but nonetheless, I wanted to bring it up. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Frawley or Dr. Rivas?
Well, I'll go first, and I'll pass on, Madam Chair, committee members. We are working closely with the Minnesota Vet Association, which represents, I believe, almost 1,400 vets around the entire state. And how they recruit, retain, inspire vets here in Minnesota, and how they provide resources. This project, like Dr. Rivas said, is a teaching hospital designed with those types of partnerships in mind so that we can give those groups like the Minnesota Vet Association tools to help offset their big job of recruiting, retaining, inspiring. The same thing goes with the University of Minnesota that we talked about earlier. We're meeting with them on a regular basis with this project to make sure that the design of it helps answers and delivers some of the solutions for those problems of recruiting, retaining veterinarians. But I'll pass it on to Dr. Reeves. She's a veterinarian, so maybe she has her own points.
Thanks, Dr. Frawley. Yes, so I think, yes, there's two key components here. One is recruitment and expanding training capacity for bringing up the future veterinarians. The second is retention in the field. We have talked a lot about, as a profession, especially in our post-pandemic years, it's a very challenging profession. There's a lot of pressures on them. We touched on in this presentation the mental health strain on the profession. And so we are one small facet of the profession in zoo medicine, but our hope is having this facility is another opportunity to just provide an increased support network for veterinarians in the state. You can imagine you're a small town veterinarian and one of your clients calls up and they've got their bunny rabbits not doing well, but you're a dog cat vet. And rabbits are hard if you don't take care of them on a routine basis. And you're out there on your own trying to figure out what to do, trying to keep your client happy, and having a support system that you can call on when you're faced with these species that you're not as familiar with, and having that backup so you don't feel like you're out on your own is one of those ways we hope to continue to support veterinarians in the state of Minnesota, because traditionally there hasn't been a really strong network of non-traditional species training in this state, and that's part of why we've been building that relationship with the University of Minnesota, is to help strengthen that aspect of the curriculum and continuing education for veterinarians once they are out in their careers.
All right. Well, thank you so much for presenting today in front of the committee, and thanks for bringing some friends with you. Appreciate your time, and we'll keep you posted as the bonding process moves along.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Let's see. Next agency we're going to hear from is the Metropolitan Council. I'm sure this committee will have nothing to ask of the Met Council. Right, Commissioner Zelli? It's going to be the easiest, Commissioner, our chair, Zelli, it's going to be the easiest committee ever. We're just going to...
The easiest committee ever.
Not pick on you, not beat you up, nothing.
Madam Chair, we actually had a pretty good, easy hearing yesterday in transportation.
Oh,
so
okay,
you got a lot,
good.
You got
so
some
he's
competition.
All warmed up then. Fantastic.
We had a wonderful meeting yesterday. And,
okay, good.
I'm thrilled to be here today. Thank you, Chair.
Wonderful.
I'm Charlie Zelli, Chair of the Met Council, and I answer to anything, so call me Commissioner Chair as far.
I just saw the C, and I just went along with it. So, all right. Chair Zelli, if you want to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. I am, as I said, Charlie Zelli, and I'm joined by Hannah Pohlmeier, who has the expert on the PowerPoint. I have a theater background, and I was told never follow children or animals when you, and I'm sorry that I have no display of a small bus or anything, but we'll be able to describe the governor's recommendation for capital investment in Met Council in three areas. They are the $15 million for a busway capital improvement program, and $4.6 million for something we call inflow and infiltration. I know many of you are very familiar with that as part of our environmental services program. And then $2.3 million for regional parks and trails bonding program. And I'll just describe each one of those very briefly and be able to answer any questions. First off, you know, we've certainly learned a lot, particularly over the past few days, that there's a lot of different modes to our transit system. And there are even differences in our bus capital program. And just as a refresher, among busways, and I don't mean the regular day-in, day-out local bus system, just the transitway system, has arterial bus rapid transit. That's all those busways with a letter. Then there's highway BRT, which is buses like the Orange Line, the Red Line, that operate primarily in easy pass lanes on the highways. And then there's guideways, which is really exciting when you think about the Gold Line, which is opening in a matter of weeks from Woodbury to St. Paul. And that has dedicated right away kind of adjacent and then sometimes on Interstate 94. So there are really three different busways. And now, you know, we're looking at some of our ABRTs that actually have some dedicated areas among its routes. We have three ABRTs operating currently. ABRTs, arterial bus rapid transit. We have the A line, the C line, and the D line. And I have to say they are very successful compared to our other modes. In fact, that they really are back to pre-pandemic levels in the A line and the C line, the D line. And we have now kind of a program of at least eight of these ABRT lines really either open, under construction, or in the serious planning stage. The B line and the E line will be opening up later this year. So for the first time for Met Transit, we're actually opening three transitways this year, and which is quite remarkable. And I think that the benefit of it is that there truly is now emerging a network of these transit ways. So it's not just about one line. It's about how they all fit together. And this bonding proposal would bring kind of a key piece of the funding for the H line. The H line is in the planning stages now, goes east-west along Como Avenue in Maryland from Minneapolis all the way to the Sunray Shopping Center east of St. Paul. And important to note that you talk about that network, it crosses 12 other transitways along the way. And Sunray is a key hub for the Gold Line that's opening in a few weeks. So to give you a sense of the financing, we have already $60 million secured. $25 million of that is federal funds through our regional solicitation. And then we believe this $15 million would be a key local match to a federal small starts program to bring in the full funding that's required of about $120 to $150 million. So we actually accomplish a lot for that $150 million when you think about the length of this line, 17 miles, and the number of connections it will make. You can see a map of where the H line is going, and that is, I can always be open to questions later, but that's the H line. On to inflow and infiltration. We don't spend a lot of time talking about the lack of capital in our wastewater system because it is well capitalized and in a good state of repair. It is truly the interstates of our metro area wastewater is underground, out of sight, on a fee basis, is one of the most efficient systems in the country, in part because smart people years ago separated the stormwater from the wastewater, and it really preserved the capacity of that wastewater system so large weather events don't flood out our wastewater system. We're able to contain it. One of the areas where fresh water, rainwater seeps into that system is through cracks and kind of a deferred maintenance of municipal pipes, which are part of the whole system. So this INI program has been very effective in helping support local communities in doing the repairs and the kind of reconditioning of their pipes, which prevents that leakage, that inflow and infiltration that grabs the capacity of our wastewater system. So as we look at this program over the years, it has been very successful, and we have these grants, which we've greatly benefit from past bonding bills, where we've made steady progress. They're generally issued on a 50% match basis. And I think the cities and communities really appreciate the program for work that really needs to be done. With that, many communities have already availed themselves of it. You can see this map, quite a few. There's a very systematic way of determining what is eligible, what is not. And I think that is something that seems to work well in terms of the science and the engineering behind what's fair and what's not in terms of how we allocate the funds. And with that, I'll just jump to our regional parks and trails
Chair Zelli, we're just going to take a member question here from Representative Hansen before we move on to another topic.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Zelli. So in inflow infiltration, you know, I'm going to ask the question, and 4.6 million is better than the one or two that we had for 15 years. But if I remember correctly with Representative Lee, we had some cost estimates that the total cost out there was over 100 million. So when we do a couple million each year, you know, rather than eating the cake or the cupcake, we're putting sprinkles on the cupcake because that money gets sprinkled around in 50K contributions and doesn't really solve the problem. And I believe former Chair Erdahl a few years ago when we didn't get a bonding bill in 22 was willing to go, you know, the amount of money we put in the PFA should be the amount equal amount of money going into INI because of the amount of people that are resolved. So the question again is, what is the total cost to complete INI? And what is the capacity of the contractors to get it done? Because the longer, if we do $4 million a year and it's $100 million, so none of us will be here, and the price will go up. It'll be another $100 million just with inflation over the time it takes to do it. So we should just get it done. And if the volume of loss continues, then we get contamination as well.
So. Well, Madam Chair.
Chair Zelli, I see you have a phone a friend.
I call the friend. I call the lifeline. And Representative Hansen, I think you asked a really salient couple of questions. One is, you know, it's a moving target. As pipes erode, repairs are made. So what is the proper pace of annual so it's in our lifetime? And then the second is, what is the industry capacity? And because those are such good questions, I did call a friend. So.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you want to state your name for the record, please, and continue?
Yes. For the record, my name is Kyle Colvin. I'm the manager of the Wastewater Planning and Community Programs Group in the Environmental Division of the Metropolitan Council. And Madam Chair and Councilmember Hansen, to answer your second question first, in 2023 legislative session, the council received, I think it was about a $12 million grants, which was offered to communities in 2024. There was a solicitation of projects, and those funds were fully encumbered. Through 2023, the amount of work that has been leveraged through the $25 million to date of that came out of the state bonding fund is about a leverage of about a 6-to-1. So of that $25 million, there's been approximately or over $150 million of local work. So these funds are highly sought after. They're fully encumbered at each offering that we have. There is some local capacity constraints from municipalities to administer these projects. These are local, these are projects that are on the municipal collection system, the public system. Through the 23 program where there was an offering of $12 million, those communities still had the capacity to administer those construction projects locally. But there is some capacity limitations for communities to do that. There's also some capacity constraints in contractors' construction activities to do this kind of work. It's somewhat highly specialized. But again, through the 23 program, the communities were able to solicit bids, go through design, solicit bids, and put plans in place to do you know the $25 million worth of work. So again, some limitations on administering the program, but there's been continued interest from the local communities to apply for these grants. In terms of the total amount of the need, the first question, Chair Zelli is correct. It's somewhat of a moving target as infrastructure ages, it deteriorates, and that offers new opportunities for this groundwater to enter into the system. So it's somewhat of a moving target. Back in 2008, the council did a study that estimated that the work to mitigate, to remove the excess INI out of the local collection systems was a little over $150 million in 2008 funds. There was also another fairly significant component on top of that that characterized or identified the source coming into the private property the private collection systems, that portion of the pipe from the house to the street. What we're talking about here today, again, is just the grants for the public infrastructure. So there is continued need. We still see through systems response, the council owns and operates nearly 200 sanitary flow meters that measures flow as it exits each community and goes into the system. After storm events, we can measure that those meters measure flow 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and we can detect when communities have excess level of INI coming into the system. We still have that today. The number of instances where that occurs has drastically decreased since the inception of the council's program in 2004, but it's still, the system still demonstrates, and some communities still demonstrate this susceptibility of the excess INI coming in into the system. So I hope that answered your questions.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think for Newport alone, it's about $14 million for a town of 3,000 people. And the pipes are in bedrock down near the river. When the flooding goes, it goes over the pipes. And I just want to point out before somebody says, well, our community's paid for INI, is I believe that when the stormwater separation from the sewer separation was done, I think that that was totally paid for by the property taxpayers in those communities. So no cost share, no assistance. And in the community I used to represent in West St. Paul, you know, there were still wooden pipes that were moving water. So leakage was pretty good on 100-year-old wooden pipes moving wastewater. And at that time, to extend the $1 million, there would be 50% cost share on seniors that were in old houses in the older part of the community. So I would hope, Madam Chair, that there is some equality when there are investments made in wastewater. If there is 80 or 90 or 100 million to the PFA and 4.6 million to the metro area, that's not equal. And it should be.
Well, that just didn't dampen the mood of this room. All right. Anybody want to add?
No, those points are well taken.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hansen. All right. I see Representative Kosnick shaking his head yes. Did you have anything to add?
Well, no, but if you don't want Representative Scraber to talk, and call on me. I just appreciate the discussion, and I think it's worth some merit and further consideration.
Okay, great. Thank you. You may proceed, Chair Zelli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going into our Regional Parks and Trails Bonding Program, this is clearly and a very also popular program where we distribute funds to the implementing agencies for capital investment. And it's very important to note that the council matches $2 for every three. So this $2.3 million will add an additional $1.53 million in regional funds that we get from our limited property tax. And just a word on this regional park system. Implementing agencies, yes, but this is as much as 55,000 acres of parkland, 500 and growing miles of trails. We heard the zoo talk about attendance. We have nearly 70 million people visiting these parks. It has really grown over the past 5 years. People have discovered the outdoors and the necessity for the outdoors and recreation in our metro area. With that, we do have also a kind of a strong consensus among the different implementing agencies of how those funds are distributed. And of that $3.8 million, this is kind of how the In the slide, you can see how it would be distributed on a formula basis. So that are the highlights of our capital funds requests on behalf of the governor. And if there's any additional questions, we're happy to stand by. And there are other Met Council experts here that I could call on.
Fantastic. Instead of who wants to be a millionaire, who wants a bonding project, right?
Okay.
Let's see. Representative Allen.
Well, just like Representative Kosnick said, if you want to keep Representative Scraba from talking, jump in. So I did.
I'm coaching both.
Let's make sure our comments are relative to today's discussion, though.
Yes. Madam Chair, I had a question around the Regional Parks and Trails bonding program that you have. You guys say you're covering close to over 65,000 acres of protected land. Of that land, how much of that is in joint partnership with, like, the Minnesota DNR or along that end of it?
Chair Zelli.
Lisa Borjas, who's here, is our executive director of our community development, which includes our park program. DNR is not part of these programs, and I'm going to show off to Lisa that I do know that. And really important that the metro area, which has so many visitors, we are funded very differently than the state park lands in greater Minnesota. You can add.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lisa Barajas, Executive Director of Community Development at the Metropolitan Council. There is a lot of partnership with the DNR in the delivery of programs and services throughout the region, as well as in connecting trails to one another. But the land that the regional parks implementing agencies own is wholly owned by them and operated by them, and sometimes with other foundation partners that help put on programs. But by and large, DNR operates independently, and the parks implementing agencies operate independently of one another. So the lands that you see depicted on this map are the lands owned by the implementing agencies. There are a lot of state agency DNR-owned properties within the metro area that are not on this map, but sometimes are contiguous with some of the regional park lands, but are largely for conservation purposes.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So why is that? Have you guys not explored any kind of partnership with the DNR, or is, you know, could you explain a little, just help me understand that a little bit more? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, can you help me with the pronunciation?
Of my last name?
Yes.
Barajas.
Barajas? Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Barajas.
Thank you. The establishment of the regional parks system happened in the 1970s, and the intent was essentially to serve as a state park system for the region, especially with a rapidly growing population, not just in the 1970s, but continuing today. We are expecting to continue to grow by 650,000 residents by 2050. And we see our parks visitation continuing to grow and outpace our population growth as well. So the establishment of those programs was meant to be independent of one another, but still jointly working with one another. I know legislators who also serve on Legacy Committee know how much we coordinate on a number of projects and work together to create a seamless outdoor recreation experience for residents and visitors to the state of Minnesota. So essentially, the council manages, by and large, with our implementing agency partners, the recreation and open space needs for the 7-county metro area and the state of Minnesota, the DNR, working with the regional parks and trails. Oh, I'm going to get the name wrong. Commission for Greater Minnesota, working together, serve the outdoor recreation needs for the remainder of Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Barajas. We have Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. So I have a bill to provide funding for Three Rivers Park District. And I see your chart here. As I recall, it's a $25 million bill. And this your chart has proposed funding for $849,000, woefully less than what the need is. And I know there's a lot of competing demands. But what's your plan to address this particular park as well as others? It's a jewel in the area. A lot of people come there, as you mentioned, and we don't have any state parks around us, so this is essentially our state park. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Brodas.
The proposal for state bonding matched by regional bonds as well as the other state funds that we receive are essentially the foundation for funding the capital needs for building out and continuing to develop the system. A lot of the agencies, however, because they otherwise are largely independently and locally funded, still have similar needs to like what you hear from the Minnesota Zoo about maintaining or investing in the existing portions of the system or modernizing them and updating them for program needs for today. So we still see our implementing agency partners needing to ask for one-time investments that help address those needs that are either from deferred maintenance or to modernize items that we are not otherwise able to fund through our foundational types of funding. We're both growing the system and trying to reinvest in it at the same time.
Thank you, Representative Carroll. All right, members, we got about 5 minutes and we're going to have to get on to the next topic. Representative Kosnick, and then we have Lead Lee.
Thank you. And real quickly then, just to kind of piggyback off of the buses and flushes, you're doing that well. Yesterday we talked about terminating the North Star service. The savings from that, how does that interact with your request for the $15 million? I know eventually, not this budget year, but just give us a quick, how would that interact?
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Great question. Chair Zelli.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Kosnick. The savings from transferring from a very expensive commuter rail to bus would allow us to continue to operate the operations costs of this entire system. You know, actually, when you think about transit now, which we're about to adopt as Met Council next month, has both increases in our frequency of our regular bus system and permanently eliminating some bus routes, which gets less notoriety, but is important to do, that we both cull a system and expand a system where it's needed. And all this diversified revenue that we have funded this system really is primarily taken up by the cost of operations. And we think about the structural deficit of those operations, which thankfully with a metro-wide sales tax has helped us fund those deficits, but also cover the costs previously borne by the counties to fully fund rail operations. So the short answer is we could use every dollar to fund an expanding system of operations. As part of the kind of transit finance over the long term, we have always had local governments and occasionally the state cover the local share of the initial capital costs, which is what this is on the H line. Clearly, our capacity to operate a system is dependent upon operating cash flow. And by taking the actions we anticipate doing with North Star, we'll help free up funds for that purpose. Having said that, curtailing North Star is going to come with a cost, and we're not sure what that cost is. That would need to be paid back.
All right. Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Lead Lee, and then we'll wrap up.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And so, Lead Lee, and then Representative Carroll. Carroll, really quick.
Chair Zelli, since we're on the BRT route, so one of your maps shows the network of the arterial, but I want to focus in on the highway BRT. So there's the one on 694-94 down. And so I'm just curious, you know, what is the work that you guys are doing in conjunction with MnDOT because of their corridors of commerce project that's going to, you know, transform Highway 252 and I-94. Is that part of the conversation now or not? Because I'm hearing a lot from my constituents that, you know, we want a mode of transit there, but it seems like that's not the response, or, you know, they're not getting traction with MnDOT.
Chair Zelli.
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, there's no question that the opportunity to expand bus rapid transit on highways or on areas not yet identified is something that we are looking at. There are various corridor studies, certainly Highway 55, anticipating Representative Carroll, which would turn into 169 going south, is something we're studying, as well as 252 going north and west. The I-94 corridor particularly, we have announced plans to extend the Gold Line from St. Paul to Minneapolis in 2027 with the 10-minute frequency that a transitway would have, and how that corridor shapes up accommodating either the Gold Line extension or additional transit is something we're very much interested in and at the table as part of the planning group. So I think that we certainly work with MnDOT to accommodate transit in that corridor. What exactly it looks like in the long run will depend upon the rethinking 94 process, but we know even in 2027 there'll be great benefit of having express routes. There is a 94 express now, but we would simply be enhancing that service and with more frequency.
Lately.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that, Chair Zelli. I think we could continue to have this conversation offline. Just want to make sure that whatever the timeline is for the 94-252 conversion, that, you know, this is part of that conversation, because we don't want to, you know, go through that whole transformation of 94 and then come back, you know, 10, 15 years down the line to add BRT. And so just switching gear a little bit to I-9 real quick. So I think one of the questions that I didn't really hear answer from Chair Hansen is more on, for this last cycle, how much of request was there that was not funded? And I think that also just to the point around the justification that we don't have the capacity, I'm concerned. I think we heard this 2 years ago where the capacity question was brought up again. And so the question is, if we don't have the capacity here in the metro area to do this type of work, then what is the justification for us to put money into the larger statewide programs? Do we actually have capacity to do that amount of funding that we put into those bigger programs, knowing that we're struggling here in the metro area?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I did.
Chair Zelli, you phoned a friend again. Okay.
Come back and give you more specificity on that capacity and what is really being requested. Question.
Yeah, Madam Chair. In regards to the request for the funds, I'd have to get back to the committee on what exactly that amount was, but my recollection was that there was about a three times the amount of the request of what the available funding supported.
Lately.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last follow-up. So just the justification that I've been hearing from the MAC Council, at least, you know, for the last two cycles now, that we don't have the workers' capacity to do the type of work. And so how do we use that justification? If that's the issue here in the metro area, then how do we justify putting money into our larger statewide programs through the Public Facilities Authority and whatnot? Do they have the capacity to do the work in greater Minnesota if we're struggling here in the seven county metro area?
Go ahead.
Yep, Madam Chair. Regarding the capacity to do work, the applicants, the communities who applied for the funds, applied for those funds based on the capacity of implementing those projects, but also these grants come with it a matching dollar fund as well, matching dollar requirement. So there's also a fiscal responsibility for communities to also kick in into those projects as well. So I can't speak specifically for, you know, on a community's behalf on their ability to fund projects. All I can say is that all the funds to date that have been offered have been fully encumbered through the requests of our application process.
All right, thank you, Lidley. Representative Carroll, and then we got to get to the Minnesota Historical Society.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be real quick. So I haven't been around long enough to become a broken record, but I think I have become one with regard to Highway 55 BRT. And if you look at your transit map, as I've mentioned before, it's a desert in the west northwest area. So you say you're studying it. I thought it had been studied plenty before, but what's the status of the study, and when can we expect buses to roll?
Chair Zelli, great question.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Carroll. I could probably get more specific in terms of timing, and I don't know the answer to that, so I'd have to get back to you. And as you know, these EBRT systems are converting existing routes that had that are being really improved. So a Highway 55 and an opportunity, as I said, in areas which have no transit service, and they are in transit deserts, and there's not just a strong interest in Met Council, but some of our county partners and others who want to identify it as a priority. So it doesn't show up on our map, but it definitely shows up on our minds. But I'll come back to you with a more specific time frame.
Mayor, just follow up. So all right, what's the status of the study for 55? And why are we continuing to study it when there's demonstrated need?
Chair Zelli.
I got a call on another lifeline. Who hasn't made an appearance?
All right. And then we have to go because we're creeping up, and I don't know if anybody wants extra credit after this, staying late tonight.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, Madam Chair, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Please state your name for that.
My name is Judd Shetland. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council. The Highway 55 corridor study that was funded in the 2023 budget bill, I think, is nearing completion. Our folks are working with Hennepin County on that, and Representative Carroll, after this meeting concludes, I will be able to send you and the rest of the committee an update on the status of that.
Fantastic. You're welcome. That's what we're here for. All right. Well, thank you for presenting. Wow. People did have some questions for you. I'm shocked. That just means we all like you.
That's great. I'll leave it a happy note. Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great day. All right. If the Minnesota Historical Society wants to make their way forward, we have Director Whitworth and Mr. Kelleher with us today. So welcome to the committee. And if you'll please identify yourself for the record, tell us who you represent, and you may proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kent Whitworth. I serve as the Director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. With me is my colleague, David Kelleher, the Vice President for Public Policy and Government Relations. Madam Chair, Lead Member Lee, and members of the committee, we thank you for the opportunity to present briefly on the capital investment needs of the Minnesota Historical Society. And before we get started, I also want to thank many of you for taking full advantage of stops at MNHS historic sites across the state. Many of you have visited our historic sites and museums, and we hope that you have found those stops enjoyable and meaningful. And as you plan future bonding tours, we've got plenty of options. As many of you know, we've got 26 different sites open to the public, well over 150 buildings. And so we hope to see you at different locations in the coming bonding tour season. So today we are going to provide a brief overview of who we are and what we do, and then we'll dive into the significant capital needs within the historic sites network of the Minnesota Historical Society, and also talk a little bit about the needs at the Minnesota History Center, as all of you know, which is right down the street here in St. Paul. Simply stated, our mission is to serve all the people of Minnesota, and we do this by creating a powerful engagement with history, to cultivate curiosity and to foster a more inclusive, empathetic, and informed society. while our facilities across the state are significant historic structures in their own right, in many cases it's what happens inside those structures that is central to us carrying out our mission. I'm sure you have taken tours in those museums and historic sites. Perhaps you have been a chaperone on a school tour visit to one of our historic sites. Or you may have experienced one of our exhibits, the current exhibit at the History Center is Girlhood. And so I would just encourage each of you to think about the power of place as we talk. Think about a historic building or place in your own history that is particularly significant. It could be significant for any number of reasons. And in essence, as the keepers of Minnesota's Historic Site Network, we're doing the exact same thing that you, your family, your community do when you think about caring for a place that's of particular significance to you. I'd like to say just a quick word about our strategic plan. Today, we understand it's not the time or the place to dig into the details, but we're going to leave the information in your handout to serve as somewhat of a reference. But as we, I want to provide just a little bit of context, and I would encourage you to look at those imperatives and look at those priorities that are driving the work of our organization. Access is at the top of that. Removing barriers so that people can engage with our programs and our resources and our services. Re-envisioning space. This is something that emerged during the pandemic when we were all challenged to think about how we could fulfill our mission virtually. So we are thinking about re-envisioning physical space and virtual space as well. Expanding authority and expertise is all about us holding the stories we tell open-palmed rather than with a clenched fist, and partnering with others who should in many cases be telling their own stories. And so all that is super important to the work we do at MNHS, but unless we're focused on creating a sustainable future, that's all at risk. So you're not surprised, I'm sure, to see the fourth strategic imperative at MNHS is talking about sustainability and aligning our human and financial resources with the priorities of our mission delivery. So in the 2025 legislative session, we are focusing on three areas in our capital budget request, and we'll spend a few minutes on each one of those, but I'll just introduce them. Asset preservation is an evergreen need of ours and obviously of our colleagues from that you've heard from earlier in this hearing. A second priority for us in this session is a county and local historic preservation grant program. And then third is our preservation and access to history, our PATH project. This is a multi-year undertaking, and right now we're really focused on the care of MNHS collections. So with that bit of stage setting, I will hand off to David Kelleher to talk about asset preservation first.
Mr. Kelleher, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm David Kelleher, Minnesota Historical Society. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about our capital budget request this morning. As Kent said, we have three requests this year. The first request is historic sites asset preservation. I believe you have in your folder this brochure, which will give you a look at the historic sites for which we are responsible across the state. We are responsible for 26 sites and a handful of others that are held for preservation. Those sites across the state hold 150 structures, half of which are over 100 years old. So those places, those historic structures, take some specialized care, both on the design side and on the construction side, when we go to do asset preservation projects. This historic sites network is a state responsibility. It's named in state law in Chapter 138, and we welcome and appreciate the partnership that we have with the state of Minnesota. And as you heard from the zoo and have heard from others, we have a series, in addition to those historic buildings, we have a network of visitor centers at these sites that are approaching their end-of-life cycle. Some of these places were built in the 1970s, 1980s, and beyond, and those need work on roofs and other elements of their facilities. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this diagram is an effort to show how we come to quantify the needs that we have in our historic sites network. And if you look at this diagram and think of it as a bucket of water and rainwater, say, and each year there is an addition to that with asset preservation or general fund maintenance dollars, but yet that bucket of water leaks out every year as buildings naturally deteriorate. And if you quantify that, if you look at the spigot, that shows as 4%. You think of a roof that maybe lasts 25 years, you need enough funding, about 4% when you get to 25 years to pay for that roof. So if we quantify that, our replacement value of our facilities is just under $400 million. If you pull aside, and that includes the History Center, but if you pull aside historic sites and then multiply by 4%, you'll come up with the bar on the right side, the bar graph, and the needs just to keep up with this regular deterioration is about $11 million each year, and you do capital budget bills every 2 years generally, so in that biennial cycle, the need is about $22 million. If you look back at what has been appropriated, the 20-year average, somewhere around $5 million, the 2020 appropriation, around $2 million. 2023, the appropriation got a little closer and is very, very much appreciated. And then our request this year is around $15 million to get to that replacement value for our facilities. Madam Chair, members of the committee, our request for historic sites asset preservation this year is on the screen, broken down into a list of specific projects. Those are prioritized. The governor's recommendation this year is $5.1 million. And if you look over on the column on the right-hand side, that $5.1 million will get where there's an underline underneath the Kelly Farm project on the top of the right, that's where that will get to. And we're showing the list of other projects that need to be accomplished over time as funds are available up to that $15 million need. And, of course, we'll be at this again for the 2026 capital budget cycle, which is coming up soon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, here's a list of projects that are in process with the 2023 capital budget appropriations. And this chart, which, apologies, is a little bit hard to read, but it gives you a sense of how we do the work of these projects. As mentioned earlier, some of the historic structures take some specialized work to do the design on those. They have reviews of the historic work, and we pace them out with design, bidding, and construction. So we're on our way to doing those projects from 2023. And I'll just quickly go through some images of recently completed projects at the James J. Hill House, Mille Lacs Indian Museum, the Forest History Center roof of the Visitor Center, and I don't know, we haven't really done a lot of ribbon cuttings for boiler systems and roofs, but maybe we need to do that in the future. Some projects that are in this current request, a roof at the Snake River Northwest Company Fur Post, Mill City Museum, Kelly Farm, Mayo House, Fort Ridgely, and more work at Fort Snelling and Hill House. Madam Chair, we cannot compete with the cute animals that the Minnesota Zoo brought. We thought about bringing a team of oxen from the Oliver Kelly Farm, but we thought that they might make a mess. We thought about some chickens from the Oliver Kelly Farm, but then we thought that might freak you out because of bird flu. So the next best thing we can come up with for show and tell is what's happening at the historic sites. There's nothing alive here.
I thought maybe there'd be food.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is what's happening at Mill City Museum. This is concrete that's fallen off one of the structures at Mill City Museum. It fell off in a non-public area, so no one is in danger, but this is what happens when buildings have a lot of maintenance and repair needs. So, careful. Madam Chair, if there are no questions on asset preservation, I'll go to the second request, which is county and local historic preservation grants. The governor's recommendation for that program is $900,000. That's for cities and counties to take care of their most significant historic structures. A match is required for that program. It's a competitive grant process. And here are some examples of recent grant projects that were funded: Railroad Depot, City Hall, Courthouse, Carnegie Library, and any hockey fans out there up in Roseau, they have a historic old barn type hockey arena in Roseau that needs a new roof.
So, Madam Chair, we'd like to take a minute and touch on the third request, which, as I said earlier, is the Preservation and Access to History Project. We refer to that as PATH. And as I mentioned, the first element of this multi-year project really focuses on collections care. Several of you were able to visit the History Center on last year's bonding tours, and you saw the areas in the History Center that we use for collection storage. This is critical. This is central to our mission, and we are caring for these collections not only for the audiences we serve today, be they scholars, History Day students, family history researchers, but we also are caring for these collections for future generations. As we like to say, we're in the forever business, and if we do not steward these collections well today, whether they are small artifacts or one among the 150 buildings that we steward, they're not going to be there to preserve and to share the story of all Minnesotans going forward. Now, in conversations over the past year, we have looked at various options, whether we purchase and retrofit, whether we build from scratch, or whether we make substantial renovations to existing facilities. And I'm pleased to report that we have sharpened our pencils and we've come up with a project, a refined project, that accomplishes three goals. The first is it will lead to the renovation of 1500 Mississippi Street. That's a facility that the state owns that MNHS uses for off-site collection storage. It's on the east side of St. Paul. The second goal that this project, first phase of this project, would accomplish is to build out the expansion space at the History Center. It's kind of remarkable when you think about the History Center being constructed almost 32 years ago. They had the foresight to include right in the History Center unfinished space to accommodate growth needs of our historical collections. And this project would build that expansion space out with HVAC and climate control. And then thirdly, it would renovate existing collection space in the History Center to make them more efficient. And so we look forward to future conversations about the PATH project. And if the committee as a whole or individual committee members would like to visit the History Center, we'd be delighted to host a visit. And so with that, Madam Chair, we are finished with our presentation and happy to stand for questions.
Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a great love for the Minnesota Historical Society, especially the center that's in my district and this capital. And I was able to tour. I wasn't on the bonding committee last year, but I've been able to tour quite a few times growing up in the space. And I want to thank Phyllis Scott for her amazing work on it and us being able to bring in some funding for the center facility. I have a lot that I can talk about offline and also in regards to workforce at the Minnesota Historical Society when we talk about the diversity, the curriculums that are in the education program. I'm an education nerd, so I have to bring that up even in bonding. Mm-hmm. But in particularly with the facilities and the data, you know, you mentioned the Mississippi address. What other projects are you going to be including going towards the future that are more culturally engaged to reflect, I mean, this environment of what Minnesota is now? When I had a capital tour of the kindergartners from Riverview dual Spanish immersion in my district, they were so excited to come to this capital. And when they see the gold horses that I witnessed as a kid growing up, and when they came to the space, the staff did not reflect the dual, the diversity of the schools in Minnesota. It was also very unfortunate, and I will say this on the record, because if I'm somebody that's caring and that cares about what happens in our state and our district, I would like that these facilities reflect all Minnesotans and also reflect the stories and talk about the sensibility. Me and my colleagues here, we may agree or disagree on many things, but we do agree that respect is to be given, and that these sensitive stories of history are to be acknowledged. And so that's something that I want to be I would hope that would be a model of the Minnesota Historical Society, whether it's right here in this Capitol, whether it's going to take a wonderful tour of the Peanuts Gallery, or going all the way up north to the Duluth Lighthouse. All of those things are monumental. So when you talk about the bonding, you talk about that, all of that's money that's building force, building history, containing all of this information of what makes Minnesota so great and how we can make it better. I just want to highlight that I would like to see more in these facilities that we are funding, a reflection of what Minnesota, all Minnesotans look like. Thank you.
Okay, who would like to take that question statement?
Madam Chair, Representative Perez-Vega, I'm happy to address that. Thank you for your challenge to the Minnesota Historical Society. We wholeheartedly agree. And would look forward to talking to you offline and with great specificity, not only about exhibits that people experience at these historic sites and museums, but also other educational programming, whether they're lectures or school tours or publications from the MNHS press, that we are striving to make sure reflects the diversity across Minnesota. So, I'm excited to say more about that, because I feel like we're closer together on that than maybe you realize. So we'll look forward to that conversation.
Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've specified this quite a bit. There's been a lot of email exchange. I've spoken with David several times. I do want to state and acknowledge the mission of MNHS and rectify that they have, you know, underreported marginalized peoples and cultures celebrated in cultural events and months. But those need to be a stagnant of the foundation. Mm-hmm. They need to be continued efforts everywhere from the displacement, the stories. And I really want to urge and put that pressure and alignment that I've been receiving from not just members on our sides of the aisle, but members on all sides of the aisles, is that if we are really putting in our Minnesotans' tax dollars to be paying millions of dollars to these institutions, that we're not just having a letter of, I felt uncomfortable in this space, and oh, kudos to that, that it's actually being worked on. I want to see it. Mm-hmm. I want to feel it with those kindergartners who feel comfortable coming into these spaces. And as somebody that served on the Capitol Board's Public Engagement Task Force, that was one of the tactics that we wanted to continue and value in that mission. Something that I talk about with, you know, Representative Schultz a lot, who serves on that board, and saying that we want to see these in the spaces that we're funding. We want to see how we can learn and grow so that we can bring more unity in the challenges that happen in history. Thank you. No further.
Okay, thank you, Representative Perez-Vega. Did you want to add something to that, Mr. Whitworth?
I would, but I can do that offline.
Okay, thank you.
I'm happy to talk specifically to the representative and the entire committee on that topic.
All right. Any other member questions before we go to Leedley? Okay, Representative Leedley, you have the final comment, question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. So hopefully I'll be quick. Just want to say, first off, thank you for hosting us on all of our tours when we have been traveling over the last few years. Just quickly on the county local historic preservation grants. And so this is an area that I'm just learning. I know that some of our county, local county, you know, historical societies may not be publicly owned. And so I think that has been a barrier for them to potentially get funding through this programs and whatnot. And so what are other type of resources that you guys could offer for them in order for them to be able to, you know, move on and work on their capital projects because of that whole public ownership issue? Thank you.
Great question, Mr. Kelleher. And we've talked about my own local historical society in the past. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, that's a great question. In addition to the historic sites that we operate, there are some 400 other local museums, which may be county historical societies or a city historical society or a topical historical society. Because this grant program typically is funded with general obligation bonds, as you observed, only publicly owned facilities, cities and counties typically are eligible for that pool of funds. So if there's a county historical society, for example, that is not owned by a city or county, one of the major opportunities for them is legacy funds. If they want to do a building preservation project, legacy history funds are available to nonprofits, tribes, cities, counties, and other educational institutions. So legacy is the primary vehicle for history organizations outside of this bond-funded grant program. And Madam Chair, Representative Lee, I would also add that if the county and local grant program were to be funded with general fund dollars at some point in the future, that would make that available for historic structures, and that's limited to historic structures. That would be available to non-public entities, have to follow a lot of the same requirements, but would be available if the language were written that way.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. That concludes today's exciting hearing. Thank you for being a part of the day. And then members, if you have questions, feel free to take them offline now. And with that, our next meeting is going to be Thursday, February 27th. And you definitely are going to want to attend this committee hearing, members, because Representative Hansen and I will be pre-gaming our birthday, which is on March 1st, okay? So we're getting the party started early, and we want to celebrate with you. So we'll hear a couple more agency presentations, and we have first local project presentations up that we have a couple from the DFL side, a couple from the Republican side, and our bipartisan spirit committee. So thank you, members. And with that, we will see you Thursday, February 27th. Meeting adjourned.